Welcome to the latest edition of The Third Wheel, Herbert Smith Freehills podcast series on all things ESG. I'm Tim Stutt, corporate partner and ESG lead for Australia, specialising in governance, market disclosure, risk management and shareholder engagement. This episode, I have a special guest co-host, Carolyn Pugsley, managing partner for our corporate practice, so my boss, my team member and a fellow governance co-conspirator. Welcome to your Third Wheel debut, Carolyn.
Thank you very much. It's taken me a while to get a gig, but I'm delighted to be here.
Today's edition is being recorded on the doorstep of COP28, about to be held in Dubai. And who better to join us than Lewis McDonald, global co-head of our energy practice. Lewis, I'll let you introduce yourself. Take it away.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be back on your podcast. I think it's a couple of years since I've made an appearance, probably after COP26, I believe. I lead the energy team over here and based in London. Looking forward to having a good discussion with you guys about COP28 and what we're going to expect there.
On that topic, exactly. COP28, or as it's more formally known, the 28th meeting of the Conference of the Parties, the UN's annual climate change conference, is about to be held in roughly 2 days, although by the time we work through formatting for the podcast, maybe it'll be a little tighter than that. It will kick off on the 30th of November and be held in Dubai. But before we get into COP28 and what to expect from the Conference of the Parties this year, we thought we might just have a bit of a retrospective over the last couple of conferences. The conference has served as a forum to negotiate, amongst other activities, the Kyoto Protocol, establish legal binding obligations and ongoing discussions between countries around how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. More recently, the meetings have also been used to negotiate the Paris Agreement, which created a general path towards climate action. Then there was also COP26 back in Glasgow, which resulted in some notable sovereign and non-sovereign commitments, including the Glasgow Financial Alliance to Net Zero.
I feel like not all COPs are created equal, I have to say, Tim. Some certainly seem to attract more publicity than others. And certainly, I should say, I am feeling a little bit intimidated on this panel because I'm the only speaker on the podcast that didn't get a position is speaking at COP26. So I note that, Tim, you were on a panel discussion in the wee hours from Australia about rethinking corporate purpose. Any takeaways that you still kind of have with you from that kind of particular session at COP26?
I do have to be honest. Having been a virtual panelist dialing in the wee hours, my defining recollection is the 2 a.m. wake up time for the 3:30 a.m. speaking gig. But more broadly, I think that the big takeaway from COP26 was around the momentum and the media coverage. It was held following the COVID pandemic, or after the previous conference had been COVID delayed. There was intense focus from the media and quite a lot of commentary about it, including from an Australian perspective, considerable pressure around our own NDC, or nationally determined contribution. Politically, as the COP unfolded, there was also a real focus around phase out versus phase down of fossil fuels, mixed views on that front, and quite a lot of unfolding coverage as the COP progressed. I think it's fair to say since then there hasn't been the same level of media interest and appetite.
I feel like COP27 basically flew under the radar by comparison from an Australian perspective at least. So
I think that's right. Some of those listening in might recall COP27 was held in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, and it did lead to an agreement around loss and damage and the mechanism by rich countries might compensate poor countries for damage caused by climate change. But actually, it was it resulted in a lot less focus in Australia in particular, but I think globally as well. It's interesting now that we have another COP on the doorstep to see how this one will unfold. I think going into it, there hasn't been intense media scrutiny. Although there has been a bit of a focus on a few issues, Lewis, be great to bring you in at this point. You're about to be a two-time COP attendee and a second-time panelist on the Sustainable Innovation Forum for Business, which runs alongside COP. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. No, look, I was in Glasgow in 2021, and it was interesting to walk around and see the level of kind of frustration and anger, if you like, that's out there on the streets. There were protests, there were a lot of banners, and you can see from those messages just the level of angst that's out there in the community, particularly among young people, I would say, about climate change. And the fact that for a lot of people, not enough is being done about it quickly enough. And I suppose those of us who are in the corporate world and who are advising those in the corporate world, you know, we have to accept that, if you like, that there is that frustration out there at how at the pace of things and how it's going. The fact is the global population is still growing. Prosperity around the world is still going up, which, you know, is a good thing. But with that, emissions still continue to rise. You know, notwithstanding the 28 COPs, as you pointed out, emissions keep rising. Our dependence on fossil fuels is also still there. You know, globally, 84% of the world's energy needs are still coming from fossil fuels. The fossil fuels that give us this prosperity also, perhaps in the long term, it may take it away, given that that is the major contributor to man-made climate change. So we've got this conundrum that we still are facing into. But over the last few years, there has been a lot of progress in relation to governments really committing to doing something about emissions. You know, the UK, for example, legislating in 2019 to go net zero by 2050, and many governments following in their lead. And just the levels of investment that we're seeing now in energy transition technologies, you know, renewable energy, batteries, grid enhancements, etc. You know, in the last 12 months, it's well above $1 trillion now that's been invested globally in energy transition. And we're starting to see the costs of some of these technologies fall to the point where they're becoming, you know, a natural choice. Solar and wind, for example. So we're starting to see real progress. We're starting to see uptick, but we continue to face this issue, if you like, that as the energy demands grow, fossil fuels are still very much part of the mix. So there's still a lot more that needs to be done, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about that at COP28.
I remember at COP26, you were talking about the level of capital which had been committed to energy transition, and the fact that you saw it as a sort of signal being sent out from the financial institutions that the capital was there to be invested, but issues around deployment and the rate of the investment. I wonder if you have any reflections on that. I think particularly at the Glasgow capital, which was committed through the Glasgow Financial Alliance to net zero, how do you see the rate of investment which has unfolded in the past couple of years?
Yeah. No, definitely. The last conference, I guess one of my key messages was that the capital is there for these projects, but the projects themselves need to be quote-unquote investable or bankable. In other words, the projects have to have the ability to produce a profit for those involved. Many projects, putting aside, let's say, photovoltaic, solar, putting aside onshore wind, most of the other renewable energy technologies are still quite nascent. You know, even offshore wind is still pretty much in its infancy, although there has been more practice going on around the world. But when you look at green hydrogen, you look at carbon capture and storage, you look at other energy transition technologies, they're still really at the beginning. Over time, and as there's more engineering practice, the costs of these technologies will fall. But we've got to get these projects deployed, you know, en masse around the world to create that engineering practice, to create the environment where the costs can fall. And that's really down to, you know, policy. It's down to regulations being set that create that environment for investment. On the one hand, it's about providing direct grants and subsidies to these technologies in order that they can be taken forward. And on the other hand, it's about putting in place carbon prices that will actually create the kind of broader environment to level the playing field with hydrocarbon technologies. And what I was saying last time around is that there needs to be more of a focus on that, more of a focus on actually creating that environment for these projects. We are seeing developments, though, on that front. For example, you know, in the UK where I'm based, there's been a huge amount of work in the last couple of years on the decarbonisation of industry, which they have always referred to as the hard to abate sector. You know, working on actually creating the instruments that will allow investment into the capture of the carbon from industry and the storage of that carbon actually under the seabed in depleted oil and gas reservoirs. And also the instruments that are going to enable green hydrogen. That's been worked on in the UK, it's been worked on in the different European states, and also in Australia, you've been working on other instruments to enable technology. So we're really seeing a lot of progress. I'm sure it's still very frustrating from the point of view of the public and in terms of what they're seeing, but definitely behind the scenes and in our offices, in the offices of our clients and the governments, there's been a lot of progress on actually developing these instruments to enable these technologies. And that's what I'll be talking about at this next COP28 is really the progress.
We will grill you about what you plan to talk about at the next COP in a minute.
And whether there'll be a song associated with it, as there was with memorably Lewis for COP26. Look it up on his LinkedIn, scroll back a few years and you'll see it for anyone that hasn't checked that out.
Before we get to that, though, Carolyn, what's your take from an Australian perspective?
It's interesting because I think a lot of the themes that Lewis has already touched on definitely apply in the Australian perspective. I think our governments probably had been further behind. There has been a flurry of policy activity and it has filled some of the vacuum that I think existed around energy policy and climate change. Equally, whilst I think things have improved, it's probably not as radically as people would have hoped. And I think there's still some key questions and inflection points that remain unresolved. And because of that, I think there is still a hold up for deployment of capital, particularly from private capital investors and big super funds. Definitely in the Australian market, they are on the lookout for opportunities to invest in the energy transition. But the comments when you talk to those investors is there's just a shortage of quality opportunities, or what Lewis would sensibly call investable opportunities. And in terms of what I think those inflection points or those pieces are that haven't quite yet been nailed down in Australia, I think one of them is there is still very much an active debate around the role of gas in Australia's transition, and the government is still continuing to send some mixed signals around where it stands on that. I think another one is that the government, in terms of how it's deploying its capital that it's putting behind in terms of incentives, is still adopting what some would call a pick a winner's approach, as opposed to, you know, you contrast that with the Inflation Reduction Act in the US that basically just sets the playing field and, you know, lets people pursue whatever opportunities they might want to invest in, and some of them will emerge as winners rather than trying to preempt that in advance. And with things like carbon capture and storage in Australia, there is still a feel that there is a bit of a foot in both camps in terms of incentives around that. And then the third thing I'd draw out is our approvals process for big projects is still incredibly slow and becoming slower. But I think even things that are more universally seen as necessary, like creation of new transmission infrastructure, even those approvals are proving slow and difficult to obtain. So, yeah, Australia is definitely suffering from a lot of the same challenges that Lewis pointed out.
Just bringing us back to COP28 and Dubai, Herbert Smith Freehills is sponsoring the Sustainable Innovation Forum this year. SIF, as it gets referred to, it's going to be held on the 4th and 5th of December and is a platform for businesses, political leaders, experts and industry stakeholders to share insights around decarbonisation, climate change and energy transition. The overall theme is transformative innovation for a nature-positive, net-zero, equitable economy, or a COP of action. We'll be joined by Silke Goldberg, who is our global head of ESG and lead of the firm's climate change practice on the third wheel shortly, who will give us a bit of a debrief after the forum. But before we get to that, Lewis, you're going to be joining a panel. What's the plan? Do you have any particular expectations going into it?
Yeah, so the panel I'm on is about decarbonisation of industry. And it's an interesting lineup. I think I'm joined by ERM, the environmental consultancy. There's a representative from one of the European governments on there as well. And then there's someone representing a particular technology. It's chaired by a BBC journalist who was a long time deployed on their international sort of operations. Anyone who's gone to a hotel overseas and switched on the BBC will have seen the journalist. So I've had my preparation session. I've gone over the points, and I've been pushed pretty hard to come up with something positive and that demonstrates action. So look, I'm going to be talking about the kind of work that we've been doing, working with the UK government to develop up those instruments basically that are going to enable the first major carbon capture projects in the UK. These projects are being worked on by the team I'm a part of in London, where we're working with some of the major oil and gas companies actually in developing up these first of kind projects. The UK is basically, they've run a competition over the last couple of years to try to look for what are the most hopeful carbon capture projects that can decarbonize entire clusters of industry in the UK. So basically create the industry around capturing carbon from entire industrial clusters, take that carbon and then pipe it out to sea and deposit it into the depleted oil and gas fields. So it's a pretty major operation. It's going to need a huge amount of government support. And our clients have been working directly with the UK government, you know, over the last couple of years to try to enable this and create the first of kind of these sorts of operations. So I'm going to share that with the panel and with the crowd and get into, you know, good conversations with others about what they're seeing. Because I think it's through the sharing of this experience and the sharing of this kind of regulatory technology, if I can call it that, I think that's going to enable decarbonisation to spread, if you like, around the world. You know, with countries like the UK, Australia, and the US really setting the example. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So Lewis, one aspect of this entire transition we haven't really touched on is the linkages between all the investment and projects that need to happen and all the exciting things that I think we're aiming to do as a global society to achieve this transition, but the trade-offs in terms of affordability of energy in particular and reliability. And, you know, those are very front and centre, I think, in each of individual countries' dialogue around transition. What are your thoughts on that, and, you know, whether that's going to be a thematic that really gets attention at COP28?
No, it's a good point, Kaz. And look, definitely over the last couple of years, there's been a hugely increased focus on energy security and energy affordability. You know, they talk about the trilemma, reliability, affordability, sustainability. And there has been a huge focus on sustainability over a long period of time. And that's definitely what sort of captures the public attention. But as I said, recently, reliability and affordability have come to the fore as they've started to be threatened by various world events, you know, Russia invading Ukraine and the inflation and interest rate increases that we've seen post-COVID. And to the point where it becomes quite palpable. For example, there was a by-election held in the UK recently where the additional costs of being imposed on high emission vehicles became the major issue in that by-election. You know, it was a £12.50 per day charge that was balked at basically and caused that election to swing in a different direction. So it's become a huge focus. And some of these things I've talked about, you know, creating these investable instruments, et cetera, they do add costs to the price of energy. You know, these the levies in relation to hydrogen, for example, will be added directly to the electricity bills of UK customers, so they will see it. And this all starts to become quite real. But over time, the costs of these technologies, they have to fall. Otherwise, energy does become unaffordable, and these things just simply won't happen, given the importance of energy. We're going to start to see a sort of a ratcheting up, if you like, of the carbon prices in Europe and the UK. And to ensure that the industries don't leave the Europe and the UK, there will be border adjustment mechanisms will come into play. So they're already being trialled in Europe. And within a couple of years, they'll be in place. So extra costs will be imposed on imported goods into Europe and the UK. This is going to create a huge incentive for low carbon technologies, because then you have a market that's going to benefit from lower carbon technologies being rolled out. And all these devices, if you like, are designed over time to increase the kind of investment in this area and ultimately the costs to fall over time. So yes, it's a huge focus, but over time we should start to see the costs fall as these technologies are rolled out.
I might wind up here, Lewis. Thank you very much for joining us on the Third Wheel today. Some excellent insights and scene setting on the eve to COP28. And thank you also, Carolyn, for your co-hosting expertise. In a future episode, as I mentioned, we'll have Silke on to talk about some of the key takeaways from COP28. Normally, we like to end these episodes with a bit of a fun fact, but today we have some fun homework instead. With the world's attention...
Fun homework. Fun homework. Like an oxymoron to me, Tim.
We're lawyers, I mean. With the world's attention increasingly focused on conservation, restoration and sustainable use of biodiversity, we wanted to point you to a questionnaire that HSF recently released. It's for businesses across all sectors seeking to benchmark their progress against biodiversity-related considerations from a governance and a due process perspective. We're hoping it serves as a useful tool for boards seeking to understand how their businesses are managing biodiversity-related risks and positioning themselves to take advantage of some of the opportunities. We'll post the link in the episode notes, but happy homework. And on that note, thanks for listening.
In the spirit of reconciliation, Herbert Smith Freehills acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. You have been listening to a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. For more episodes, please go to our channel on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud, and visit our website, herbertsmithfreehills.com, for more insights relevant to your business.